This is Mike Farrell. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Host Keith Brown-Ill talks with Reggie Clemens about his case, why he took the plea deal after the Missouri Supreme Court gave him another trial, and where he goes from here. Then, in the second part of the broadcast, Keith speaks with Jamala Rogers, a longtime human rights activist in St. Louis who has been very involved with the Free Reggie Clemens Committee, about the effect of the plea and what is next for his supporters. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Now, to Keith and his guests.
Reginald Clemens, a former death row prisoner, has been fighting his case in Missouri courts for the last 27 years. His convictions were eventually overturned by the Missouri Supreme Court because it found that St. Louis police officers had beat a confession out of Reggie, deleted critical information from their police reports, and destroyed key pieces of evidence which ultimately were used to obtain his multiple convictions. In spite of all of this, the state was preparing to use the same tainted evidence all over again at the second trial, including the perjured testimony of Reggie's alleged co-defendants who had initially cut a deal with the state to testify against him in exchange for more lenient sentences. Both victims in this case were white, and one of the white co-defendants was actually the main perpetrator of the crimes. He too was given a lenient sentence by the state because it wanted to make it appear that this case was all about a group of black male criminals committing violence and murder against two young white female victims. Reggie's case gained attention and support from Danny Glover and other well-known activists. Still, the outcome of the state's second attempt to convict Reggie ended in a plea agreement because Reggie had public defenders who were unwilling to put up the necessary fight for him. And the deck was so heavily stacked against Reggie, it was obvious that a second return to death row was imminent. The plea agreement for 5 parolable life sentences, which the state was able to extract from Reggie, was literally strong-armed from him, like in the cases of so many other innocent suspects. On the morning of my interview with Reggie, I watched a report which Fox News did concerning Reggie's recent plea agreement. The reporter and one of the police investigators were ranting and raving about how Reggie finally admitted his guilt after misleading all of these people who were aiding him in his plight to prove his innocence. Now it's time to hear Reggie's side of the story, and we will also hear from two of his supporters, his mother, Vera Thomas, and one of his longtime supporters, Miss Jamala Rogers. My name is Keith Brown-Ill. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio.
Well, my name is Reginald Clemens, and I've been fighting this case since 91.
So the first two questions I want to ask you is, did you commit this crime, and did you actually plead guilty?
No, I did not commit this crime, and yes, I did plead guilty. But what needs to be understood is, for those that don't know about the Chain of Rocks Bridge case out of St. Louis, that involves a lot of police brutality and prosecutorial misconduct and corruption, where they went to extremes in order to try and secure a conviction. And all this stuff has been exposed on the record. So under the circumstances, I knew the best decision was to take a guilty plea. And what my lawyers explained to me is that the guilty plea would not require me to plead guilty to doing anything that I didn't do. They told me that the guilty plea would be me pleading guilty to failing to stop anything from happening. And there's no way that I could bring myself to plead guilty to a crime or say that I'm guilty of a crime that I'm not guilty of. Yeah. And as far as the police officer, I don't know what his name was. What they trying to do is figure out a way to cover themselves from things that have been proven and established in the record when it comes to their level of corruption and police brutality, where they've been beating people and destroying evidence and tampering with evidence.
Now, was this an actual guilty plea or was it an Alfred plea?
Well, in the state of Missouri, they don't recognize alpha pleas, but they do recognize nulla contendere pleas. So what the lawyers said they did was they crafted it as an alpha plea as far as its legal effect. And that's what an alpha plea, if I don't know if they have it on Google, but under legal terminology is when you don't plead guilty to committing a crime, but you plead guilty to failing to stop a crime.
Well, the research that I did, it indicated that an alpha plea, which is recognized in Missouri, it's the only plea that's similar to that that's recognized in Missouri. The alpha plea is when you acknowledge that there probably is enough evidence to convict you of a crime, regardless of whether you're innocent or guilty, and you're entering a plea to avoid going to trial. The reason why I asked you that question is that a lot of people, and I've heard some judges say this, that a alpha plea is essentially a guilty plea. It's not. An alpha plea is an alpha plea. A guilty plea is a guilty plea. And the very purpose of an alpha plea is to avoid having to have any admission of guilt. So I don't know what the situation was, other than what you have told me about what the lawyers pled you to in the courts. But I think what they probably did is gave you some bad advice about entering the plea. Now, we talked earlier and you said that you had some reservations about how the lawyers were representing you in court. You want to talk a little bit about that?
There was quite a few instances I wanted the lawyers to challenge and raise the issue of police brutality as it related to the evidence. One example is the two police officers that beat me into a confession was on the state's witness list. And when I asked the lawyers to challenge their testimony or challenge their ability to be able to testify, since I'm saying my case got vacated and thrown out based on those two police officers beating me, my lawyers told me that they was not going to make police brutality part of their strategy in my defense. And that the primary reason that they took the case and their principal strategy was based around preventing me from getting the death penalty. Their primary interest in the case was not trying to get me an acquittal or get me a verdict of not guilty, but their primary focus was getting me life without parole in order to help me avoid the death penalty. That's where we was completely on two different pages as far as that strategy was concerned.
Now, did the lack of cooperation that you were receiving from your attorneys, did that influence your decision to enter a plea that you made?
It had quite a bit of influence on me weighing things out, because I was only end up going to trial with public defender's office instead of a private counsel. And we tried to get money donated and we tried to raise money, but in the past 15 years, my mother and I have only been able to raise less than $1,500. That's not so much as far as from the campaign of Justice for Reggie when it comes to donations and stuff. But we've never been able to accumulate any donations or anything enough to raise money for counsel, because I know a lot of people know about Scott Rosenblum.
Right.
He gave us a prospective price point to retain him for the case at $75,000. And when we put the Justice for Reggie donation site is still up, but I'm saying nobody's ever went and donated money to the website. So, yeah, it played a major role in my deciding to take a guilty plea. And taking into consideration how long I've been fighting and what the first trial was like, what it put my family through, what it put the victim's family through, and me potentially being executed back in 2009, and my lawyers looking to give me life without. At one point, they tried to get me to do a plea deal for life without. And there was no way I could bring myself to take life without for a crime I didn't commit.
Okay, now when you went to trial the first time, did you have a paid attorney or did you go with a public defender?
Well, when we went to trial the first time, we had a private counsel, but there was a payment plan set up because we didn't have any money to really pay him. So there was a payment plan set up, but it ended up turning out that he was ineffective and eventually got disbarred for 76 lawsuits that was filed against him for his ineffective assistance of counsel. So there again, I'm saying I was poorly represented in that situation.
Okay, now tell us exactly what you were pleading guilty to when you entered your plea this time, or what you were told you were pleading guilty to.
Well, what was explained to me was that I would be pleading guilty to second degree, not to committing the crime of a second degree murder, to failing to stop the rape or robbery, and that I'd be getting 5 life sentences with the possibility of parole. And because I've got 27 years in, it would be possible for me to get immediate release. But that would be up to the parole board.
Okay, now can you talk a little bit about what your actual involvement was in this crime or what your involvement was not?
Well, right now, in order to be considered for parole, you have to take full responsibility for crime and your role in different things.
Right, as far as the parole board is concerned.
Right. And what is...
If you make any denials, you automatically deny parole.
Correct.
Okay.
So, then taking that things into consideration, and like I said, it's one of the reasons I avoided going to trial is to spare my family the pressure of me possibly getting the death penalty and them going through a long, drawn-out trial and the victim's family from... I was saying, because at the end of the day, there's real people involved in this case, and there's a lot of pain and suffering, and a trial would just... cause even more pain and suffering. And I remember, I know you asked me what was my involvement in the case. Well, as a prisoner, saying people don't take your word for too much of anything.
Right.
And Thomas Cummins, in his testimony, one of the things that was brought out that I had argued for none of this to be taking place, and that I had argued against them being killed or anything. That's one of the reasons the state came with the offer of second degree, is because there was a lot of evidence of me not being involved and me speaking against the murders or me speaking against the crime taking place.
Now, you don't have an actual rape charge, you just have the murder charges?
The state would only take the deal if I pled guilty to both rape and robbery.
What kind of impact has this had on your family, these years that you've been on death row and going through the trial?
My family understands that taking the guilty plea was the best decision. Some of the people in my family feel like I should have went to trial because they feel like I could have still gotten acquittal since I didn't kill anybody and I didn't rape anybody or rob anybody. But you never know what a jury is going to say.
Exactly.
Even though there's no evidence to support me being involved in the rape robbery or being complicit in the murder, because the state's case was that I spoke out against a murder taking place. And that's another reason why an alpha plea was entered, because of the lack of evidence in the state's case.
Now, how many people were involved in this, or allegedly involved in the situation?
Well, there's four co-defendants. I've got three co-defendants. Antonio Richardson and Daniel Winfrey, they were both juveniles. Daniel Winfrey was a white co-defendant. And because Daniel Winfrey was a white co-defendant, what it did was it took and created a situation where it was impossible for the state, even though they tried to make it a racial issue, but it, because there was a white co-defendant involved, it was hard for them to make it a racial issue as far as, like, a bunch of black animals attacking some just on a rampage or whatever, how they like painting things indirectly as a racial issue, but they couldn't do.
In other words, they wanted to make this about some black people killing some white people, right?
Right. But there wasn't a situation where you had all black co-defendants. So that spin was something that they never could get the stick, but they tried to put that spin on it. And then another co-defendant was Marlon Gray. He was 24 years old at the time. I was 19 at the time. Antonio was 16, and Daniel Winfrey was 15. Daniel Winfrey testified on behalf of the state, which is one of the things that helped the state secure a conviction. But since then, Marlon Gray has been executed. He got executed in 2005, and I almost got executed in 2009. And I've maintained my innocence throughout my fight against being wrongfully executed. I've maintained my innocence throughout fighting to prove that the police beat me into a confession and to prove that the prosecutor tampered with evidence and destroyed evidence and threatened witnesses in the case, which eventually in a hearing in 2011, the prosecutor admitted to tampering with evidence, destroying evidence and threatening witnesses and to not testify. And that's something that does not need to be overlooked in any way, shape, form, or fashion.
Okay, now what evidence was destroyed and tampered with?
Well, Nels Moss, he passed away in, I think, June of 2015. He altered and edited exculpatory evidence out of the police report.
A written police report or a video recording?
A written police report. It was in his handwriting, omit this, edit this, take this out. And it was like about four pages of documented evidence and different things that he had taken out of the police report.
And this was exculpatory evidence?
Yes. And then he also threatened a witness named Warren Weeks into not testifying. He threatened Michael Chappie into not testifying. Those are the people that we know about.
What would they have testified to?
Well, Warren Weeks would have testified that he had seen my injuries and seen how badly I was injured from the police brutality, and that he knew about or heard about the police brutality. He worked in the police department, and he was a witness on behalf of defense, or would have been a witness on behalf of defense.
What did he
had Nels Moss and a supervisor at the St. Louis City Police Department. He was called into the office of his supervisor, and Nels Moss was in the office, and Moss and the supervisor had edited and scratched out things that he had entered into the report that he submitted. And they had basically let him know that if he tried to press this issue, it could make things, it could cause problems for him.
So Moss was more or less intimidated into taking certain things out of the report, right?
Warren Weeks was intimidated, yeah, into not speaking up, because they had already scratched out his notation on the report.
Well, what did Warren Weeks, was his specific job at the police department?
He was a part of the intake process, and after a person is interrogated or questioned or whatever, he was part of the process of interviewing a person, getting their name, and going over what their records was, and he's part of the booking process.
Oh, okay.
Is he still? Another evidence that disappeared is there was some clothes found on the body of Julie Carey.
That's one of the victims, right?
Yes. It was Robin and Julie Carey were the two sisters that died, and they were said to have been pushed from the bridge naked. But when Julie Carey's body was found, there was clothes on the body, and the last person that had those clothes in their custody was Nell's mom. But those clothes disappeared, and there's an interview on the internet with Nels Moss and Charles Jaco, and on the Jaco Report and Reddit Hudson, where Jaco is the moderator,
uh-huh.
And it's called the Jaco Report. And when Nels Moss was asked what happened to the clothes, he said it happened to it. And he was asked what's it, and then he claimed that nobody had ever asked for the clothes, but there was a specific request in discovery for the clothes that was found on the body, because that's inconsistent with the state's theory of the case. And that's where, it was obvious that Nels Moss had tampered with and destroyed evidence. And to this day, those clothes that was found on the body have never turned up.
Now, was the body of the other person who was the victim ever located?
No. Robin Carey body has never been found. And that's what I would like people to keep in mind, is to prove that the prosecutor tampered with evidence, to prove police brutality, is to this day almost impossible. And it's because the prosecution has complete and total control over the evidence that comes out of the police department. And really, there needs to be a neutral, non-biased party who handles the evidence that comes out of the police department. And that way, you would have less issues of destruction of evidence and tampering with evidence. And you wouldn't have to worry about whether or not the prosecutors feel obligated to cover up police brutality. Because if a prosecutor seems to be in an adversarial position with the police, prosecutors feel like the police won't cooperate with them, and they feel like they have a mutual obligation to protect one another.
Yeah.
Well, if the police turned the evidence over to a non-biased neutral party or entity, you wouldn't have the problems that have arisen in this case.
Right, and I'm sure there have been many other cases just like yours.
Yeah, and it's a pattern. It's become a pattern and a practice. I'm saying either through intentionally or unintentionally or through human behavior. I'm not qualified to make those type of analysis, but in my particular situation, at the end of the day, I haven't killed anybody, and I didn't agree to kill anybody. And it's because of the prosecutorial misconduct and corruption in the case that I ended up on death row.
We talked earlier, I think maybe it was maybe a year or so back, or maybe a few months back. You had communicated to me that you were not being allowed to have private phone calls with your attorney, and that you had to make phone calls to them that were being recorded by the prison officials who were in a position to hand over information to the state about your case.
Yes.
Is that practice still going on, or was that going on during the time that you were trying to get back in court?
The practice was going on then. There was a special master investigation during my trial that I felt and believed should have went further than just my phone calls from the St. Louis Justice Center, because I had filed a lawsuit about them listening to my phone calls during my appeals.
Right.
One of the ways that the Attorney General's office defeated the lethal injection litigation was by listening to individuals' phone calls during the lethal injection litigation and listening to our phone calls during appeals. And since then and today, to this day, which is, what's today's day, February what?
It's the 5th.
Yeah, to February 5th, 2018, there is no law, no rule or policy that prevents the prosecutor from continuing to obtain jail records and phone calls without a warrant or without a subpoena. Like right now, they can still listen to any of my legal calls.
Now, how can folks...
This call is from a correctional facility and may be monitored and recorded.
How can folks find out more about your case? And do you have a website?
Well, they can go to justiceforreggie.com or justicewatchforreggie.com. And the reason that it's still up to accept donations, if people are interested in still helping us fight this case, and there's a police brutality lawsuit pending, and I've been trying to find an attorney or find somebody who's willing to help me fight this police brutality lawsuit. My case was reversed based upon police brutality, and it needs to be exposed. And the blue coat and blue curtain of silence and the blue shield of fraternal protection, it's not easy to penetrate through that, but this is an opportunity to shed some light on police brutality. And if anybody wants to help, they can contact justiceforreggie.com. They can donate to justiceforreggie.com, or they can try and keep up with any new developments in the case in relation to parole and probation with justiceforreggie.com.
I'm certainly glad you pointed that out and you have that information available, because I think what happened in your case is very important. It has a lot of ramifications that affect other people's lives. And I have been aware for quite some time that these things are occurring and very frequently in the city of St. Louis, in the county, anywhere you're in St. Louis, and they're taking place all over the state of Missouri and, in fact, all across the United States. And it deserves more attention. So even though you may be stuck with the five life sentences that you now have to do, I think that there are other issues that need to be explored in your case. And I'm glad that you are continuing in your fight to do that.
I'm just doing my best to make things better and help out.
I'm sure that the people who have been trying to fight for your defense, I'm sure that they'll be willing to continue to make those efforts as well. And we do thank you for your time, sir. And best luck to you on your efforts to try to obtain parole.
And last but not least, one of the most important things that my case highlights and several other cases highlight that have been able to expose various flaws, human flaws in the system, is that the system is not perfected enough or exact enough in order to implement the death penalty or utilize the death penalty, because wrongful convictions show that innocent people are often executed. It's not allowed within the system for anybody to challenge the innocence or guilt of somebody after they've been executed. So that means there's innocent people that have been executed but will never be exonerated.
They know the way the system is set up is that once a jury comes back and they say you're guilty, they finalize the conviction, so they won't allow any further inquiries into that. And you're right, that does need to change. And if they were to allow that, they would probably uncover God knows how many cases where innocent people have been convicted, they've been sentenced to death and executed, and just basically in prison serving the rest of their lives or substantial amounts of time for crimes that they didn't commit.
And those imperfections are all the more reason why we don't need to have a death penalty, especially at this time.
Even experts now, they will tell you that the system is broken, and we can only continue to hope and pray and do what we can out here to try to see that it gets fixed, if it's possible. So I do thank you for your time, sir, and I'll try to keep in touch with you and let the public know about
and
any recent developments in your case.
I hope that I answered all your questions to as satisfactorily as possible.
You did an adequate job. But like I said, we'll try to keep in touch and keep the public informed about your situation and any other developments in cases that are similar to yours. So you take care, and we'll keep our fingers crossed, and we'll say a prayer for you.
All right. Thank you, and God bless you.
All right. God bless you, too.
Now, the calendar for February 5th. The Criminal Justice Task Force will meet Monday, February 5th, from 6:45 to 8:45 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd, 4947 Choteau Drive, KCMO. The Criminal Justice Task Force's mission is to lobby the Missouri State Legislature for sentencing laws that are fair and basic human rights for those that are incarcerated. For information, contact Robin Johnson at 816-522-4081 or email redrob, that's REDROB 2655 at yahoo.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, February 6th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. The Kansas City Chapter of Empower Missouri's February Friday Forum will be Friday, February 9th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Westport Flea Market, 817 Westport Road, KCMO. This month's guest will be Lindsay Baker, the Outreach and Policy Specialist with the Missouri Budget Project. She will be talking about this year's legislative session, bills proposed, and possible budget cuts, and more. The KU School of Law will hold an expungement clinic from 11:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, February 10th at the First Christian Church, 221 West 10th Street, Lawrence, Kansas. Those who have been arrested or convicted of a crime can receive legal representation in Douglas County District Court or Lawrence Municipal Court to have their arrest records or convictions sealed from public view. Stand Up KC and the new Poor People's Campaign is commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Memphis sanitation strike led by Martin Luther King. Join low-wage workers and allies on Monday, February 12th, 11:30 a.m. at 4526 Paseo Boulevard, KCMO, and March for Racial and Economic Justice at 12 noon. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. And now, back to Keith Brownell and his guest, Jamala Rogers.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is the program we call Jaws of Justice. My name is Keith Brownell, and I'm your host for today's show. We just finished playing a pre-recorded interview of Mr. Reginald Clemens, a former Missouri death row prisoner who was wrongfully convicted. In the second half of the show, we are going to be talking with Reggie's mother, Ms. Vera Thomas, and a longtime activist in the city of St. Louis, Ms. Jamala Rogers. Good morning, ladies, and welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Thomas,
yes.
Could you please tell our audience what your state of mind was and the condition of your heart when you first heard the verdict that in Reggie's case and you learned that he would be headed to death row?
I could guess you say I was in pretty well in a state of shock at that point, especially when I heard the jury polling and each one stating death. It was just unbelievable how Reggie wound up, how we wound up all the way from his home, from his room, his home, to death row.
All right, Jabala, what are some of the other high-profile cases or not-so-high-profile cases you've been involved in and been an advocate for in St. Louis and elsewhere? And can you tell us how you became involved in Reggie's case and some of the other criminal defendants that you've been advocating for?
So thank you for having me. And I would say that most of Missouri's wrongfully convicted, exonerated folks we've been a part of, and when I say we, I mean the Organization for Black Struggle. So, you know, starting with a 16-year struggle for Ellen Wiesenhofer to be free, and then on to, you know, many other ones, Daryl Burton and others in Missouri. But, you know, one of the things you have to do with a case like Reggie's is to use it as a case study to show how corrupt and unjust the system is. And so, of course, we were fighting all along for Reggie to have a stay in court. That was the most important thing, because that's what his demand was. He needed his stay in court to tell his side of the story. And so the Justice for Reggie campaign honors that request, and that's what our work was around, letting people know what happened, trying to create an environment for a justice-seeking court appearance. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. We came pretty damn close, but I think with the plea bargain, that was pretty much crushed. And I think Reggie did a good job of explaining, you know, why he took the Alford plea. But again, we're going to continue to use this as a case study, because I think one thing that most people don't understand is of the 2.2 million people that are in the U.S. cages across this country, almost 2 million of them are there on plea bargains. So people think that there's this thing about going to court and you have a jury. Very few people see a jury trial. Most of these cases, Keith, are plea bargains. The problem with that is it's a fairly secretive process that is controlled by the prosecutor. And also, it invites abuse and entrapment of folks who are innocent, who are factually innocent. And so when you have a situation like Reggie did, where you have a hostile prosecutor, because as you know, his case was taken out of the city prosecutor's office and taken to the state, which put it in a hostile environment. And then you have a case that's 25 years plus old, where people have died, evidence has been degraded, corroded, you know, lost, stolen, all of that. It is very difficult, as Reggie said, to make your case. And so you're facing the death penalty, and you don't know which way a jury's going to go. That's a hell of a position to have people in when they're fighting for their own innocence and fighting for justice.
And it's not always the case that you're going to have unbiased jurors that sit on your jury. A lot of these counties, they select jurors solely from locations that they know are pro-law enforcement and will basically go along with anything that the police allege or the prosecutor says happened in the case.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think when your defense attorney presents to you all of the obstacles, you know, you have little choice for a lot of defendants but to plea bargain. Because you're looking at that factor in particular, a jury that's not going to be of your peers, that's going to be in a death-qualified jury. You know it's not going to be a jury of your peers. It's going to be mainly white people. And so you have to look at that to say, do I want to start this process all over again that he started in 1991 and came pretty close to being executed in 2009? Do you really want to go through that again? Do you want to take your family through that? So, yeah, some hard decisions have to be made in those cases.
Yeah, and Reggie, he pointed that out in his interview. And he didn't only highlight the fact that, you know, he was tired of taking his family members through the stress. He also indicated that, you know, he felt compassion for the victims' families, you know, because he felt that they had been through enough. And, you know,
absolutely.
When you have these jury trials, a lot of times you're going to have people on there that haven't had any real contact with people who've been involved with the criminal justice system. I mean, I don't know where you, what planet you find those people on anymore. You got 2.5 million people on the one fourth of the world's population here in America. World's prison population is right here in America. So I don't know where you could go to find anybody who hasn't had any contact with somebody that's been in prison. You know, but they managed to come up with them somewhere along the line every time they want to have a jury trial. And if they do pop up, then most of the time they get stricken off the jury unless they just have an extraordinary number of people who are sitting on the jury and they can't just get them all off of there. Ms. Thomas, what was the first steps you took as far as trying to organize Reggie's defense or help him organize the defense after you was able to collect your senses?
First step, I started to going to meetings where there was activism going on. And I had met Jamala Rogers over the years, and I knew that she was involved in the justice system issues. That was my first step. My next step was to find out more as much as I could about the justice system, which I went to the library and did research on that, and then started looking for an attorney. Found out that attorneys run anywhere, good attorney, from $150,000 to $200,000,
yes,
which was something we absolutely was not going to be able to afford.
Exactly.
So we wound up with a very incompetent attorney.
And
it's like a roller coaster downhill from there.
And you know, that's one thing I always try to make people realize when I talk to them about their cases in their pending trial. A lot of people think that just because you have you are able to hire an attorney, that something magical is going to happen in your trial and that, you know, you're going to get a representation that you wouldn't necessarily get with a public defender. The rate of acquittals, I checked the statistics, and they're about the same for public defenders and paid attorneys. You know, it's not very high, but, you know, most paid lawyers, they don't do any better than the public defenders do if you go to trial. You know, that's something that a lot of people should look into before they. It's a lot of times it's about hiring. It's about who the lawyer knows, you know, the type of strings, the strings that he can pull. You know, you can't just go out and get any lawyer and hand him and throw money at him and tell him to, all right, go in here and represent me in this case. You know, and I wish people would try to come to that realization of that.
True.
I get the impression from talking to Reggie, I've been knowing him for quite some time now, that this experience that he has undergone has been a great enlightenment to him. Did he have the level of consciousness that he prior to this that he has now?
In regard to the criminal justice system?
I'm just his outlook on life in general.
Oh, he is a very optimistic person about life, had a very creative man and was interested in inventing things. He would do things in home. I mean, come home, you never know what he had generated. I come in his room one time and lights flashing all over the wall, things like that. No idea of going where we are now. Reggie would talk about things like inventing cures for AIDS and things of this nature. He was always thinking in terms of people. Not at all.
Did he get good grades while he was in school?
He did. He did pretty well, particularly in math. He was very good in math. We wind up going to private school. I was able to get him into, and he did very well with that. There's a few other issues that he dealt with, because he was always, to me, his thinking was always ahead of where he was. And sometimes people have a hard time understanding that. They kind of put you in a box, and you wind up limited. Your abilities get limited.
And he had
I would say he was a thinker.
And he had never been in any trouble prior to this, right?
No, sir, he had not. Mm-hmm. In fact, when he got locked up, I picked up business cards he had. He had started working on a small business. So that was not in the plan anywhere. He was 19 years old. I'm thinking, okay, we can kind of rest a little bit. He's gotten this far, don't have a record, and boom, just the whole world just sort of turn around.
And Keith, one of the things that I talk about when I'm presenting Reggie's case to people is exactly what you're saying. You had a family that had no knowledge of how corrupt the system is. Mm-hmm. And so when I tell people, for example, that when the detectives came to Thomas's home to quote, allegedly get Reggie and take him downtown for questioning, Vera specifically asked, do I need an attorney to be there with him? And you know what they said? No, of course not. We'll bring him back. And that was the very last time that Reggie was free. And so people say, well, she was pretty naive. I said, well, you have to understand, this is somebody that, you know, generally when the police say we're going to do something, you believe it. And so why wouldn't you? I mean, why would they tell a bold-faced lie like that? But I think one of the things that both the Thomases and Reggie have learned is the degree of corruptness. And Reggie has made it his life's work to also learn about the justice system so that he can help other people. So he's often available to other prisoners to help them with their case, and he is the primary motivating factor as to why there were additional law books collected for the Justice Center here. Why he stayed maybe like a year and a half. So there was a collaboration between the Organization for Black Struggle, the NAACP, and the MacArthur Justice Center to collect legal books and legal resources for those prisoners housed at the Justice Institute. So he's very interested in that, very interested in that, although that's not his passion. His passion is inventions and drawings. He's a hell of an artist. He's very creative, and when you think about the fact that that's been crushed or suppressed at, you know, serving 25 years in life, what would he have been, and what would his contributions be to our society had he been allowed to flourish and develop and grow?
Oh, there's no doubt that, you know, I think this is nothing less than an absolute tragedy because, you know, he seems like a person that has so much to offer and contribute, and I think he probably would have been a great mentor as far as trying to steer other young people, on, you know, keep them out of these type of situations where they could possibly end up in prison, you know. And then it's also the case that the reason why the conditions in prison are so bad nowadays, I mean, they've always been bad, but years ago you had more people in prison like Reggie who were advocates and would try to fight for the rights that the law gave them or they was allegedly supposed to have. You know, you cannot just rely on the Constitution alone and think that it's going to magically produce rights for you and make people do the right thing. You have to be in their faces. You have to confront them. Sometimes you have to do these things at great risk to your personal welfare. But your rights have to be fought for. And a lot of people in prison, they have this attitude now that I'm just going to lay back and roll with the flow and maybe something will come my way, you know. You know, like Reggie is essentially now, I mean, he's in a situation now where he can expect or he's looking to try to make parole. And, you know, that's probably going to have somewhat of a neutralizing effect on his activities because you can be severely penalized for doing things that the prison officials don't like. It don't have to be illegal. You know, it can just be something that, you know, they rather not see you do. And I used to tell people this all the time when I was in prison. I tell them, you were morally right, but you're strategically wrong, you know. And
right.
I really do hope that something will happen for him. You know, there used to be a time in the criminal justice system and in the parole system that if this was your first offense, you know, you had never had any trouble before in your life, you got a little more consideration than people who had repeatedly been in trouble throughout their lifetime. They don't seem to give that a lot of consideration anymore. So there's not a lot of hope that, you know, that's going to go a long way to help him. But
right.
I think I'm very happy to learn that at least he don't have to go back and sit on death row again. And we talked yesterday and he told me that he does want to continue to use this situation as a case study. you know, there's there's not a lot of anybody else can do for him right now because of the situation that he's in. But we can keep calling attention to all of the circumstances that led to him being on death row. Does anybody have any closing comments before we get ready to go?
Well, the thing I would say is that there are many, particularly African-American families who have a loved one in prison and who basically feel trapped and disempowered. But I would say, you know, you need to look and join organizations where you're not just a committee of one fighting this gargantuan system whose only goal is to suppress and repress and control. And so, you know, you got organizations like CURE, you got organizations like, you know, Missouri for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. And so those are folks who have been in the trenches in these cases. And so don't feel alone. Don't be alone. It's strength in numbers.
Exactly. And I tell people that every day. If you can't, I mean, everybody needs to be in something with the kind of situation that we're up against and the things that we're dealing with, you know. And I just can't imagine why people would walk around out here in society or even in prison and not try to be a part of some type of activity that's trying to, that's geared toward changing things. Ms. Thomas, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yes, I would like to say I know that Reggie will continue the fight for justice. He's written books since he's been in there. He's written up documents since he's been in there about economic issues of all type of things, always thinking about people and thinking about society in that manner. So I know this is something that he will continue to do.
Didn't he also write a book while he was in prison?
Yes, he did. Poetic Reflections. Mm-hmm. He wrote another book dealing with economic status, and he's working on some materials also at this time. So he keeps himself very busy, looking forward and working on projects.
And that is,
I'm saying, he get in trouble for doing that. Yeah. But he continues to think in those areas.
Trying to keep yourself busy is very necessary in prison because it helps you maintain your sanity. And I want to express my sincere gratitude to both of you for coming on the show today and giving us some insight into some things that we didn't have when we first started out trying to look into this situation. And I hope both of you will continue to do your work and the other things that you that need to be done in our community. And thank you very much.
And thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Keith. And you keep up the good work, too.
I'll try.
Yes. Yes, you're doing great. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Sure. Bye-bye.
It's the 420 Drug War News. I'm Doug McVeigh. There's a new report from the Drug Policy Alliance, From Prohibition to Progress, a status report on marijuana legalization. With more on that report, here's the report's author, DPA staff attorney Jolene Foreman.
With marijuana legalization success, the question is no longer whether to legalize, but how. There's a clear need to prioritize policies focused on repairing the racially discriminatory harms of marijuana criminalization and enforcement. Several states are taking steps to do this through a variety of policies. These include efforts to increase equity in the regulated marijuana market, allowing stores to be licensed for on-site marijuana consumption, decriminalizing marijuana for youth and young adults under age 21 so that minor marijuana law violations no longer result in a young person getting entangled in the criminal justice system, and reinvesting marijuana tax revenues in the communities most harmed by marijuana criminalization. The report recommends additional policy changes, such as reforming police practices pertaining to marijuana enforcement and collecting demographic data on marijuana arrests and people working in the marijuana industry. Though Attorney General Sessions has signaled that the Department of Justice might go after some state marijuana operators, this report shows us that states should stay the course. They are effectively protecting public health and safety through their marijuana laws. It doesn't make sense to interfere with these successful programs. Instead, this report demonstrates that states should continue evolving and improving their marijuana laws so they benefit the most people and begin to repair the harms of prohibition. The report shows that legalization in these states is protecting federal priorities as well as state priorities by protecting youth, road safety, decreasing opioid-related harms, and more. Now that Attorney General Sessions has rescinded the Obama-era Cole memo, which provided U.S. attorneys guidance on federal marijuana enforcement, federal prosecutors will be exercising their regular discretion as to when to prosecute and when not to. It would behoove them to work cooperatively with the states rather than to disrupt what is proving to be a positive public policy shift. The federal government can't stop states from legalizing. All they can do is disrupt the regulatory schemes that states are using to protect the public and cause fear and uncertainty, which will only lead to worse public policy and public health outcomes.
A copy of the DPA's new report, From Prohibition to Progress, a Status Report on Marijuana Legalization, is available on their website, drugpolicy.org. This was a production of the Drug Truth Network, online at drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.